It's episode 91 of Dive in the Podcast with special guest Michael Schwinghammer. Dive in the Podcast is an all about diving podcast for everyone. Whether you explore the oceans as a snorkeler, scuba diver, free diver, or tech diver, Dive In has something for you. The show is filled with diving news, feature interviews with guests from around the world, interesting dive topics, and ocean advocacy. Visit diveinpod.com to find out more about the show, past guests, and our Patreon.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nick, and my book recommendation is called Changing Tides.
Hi, everybody. I'm Justin.
I'm Amit, and we're the hosts of Dive in the Podcast.
Before we get started today, we'd like to thank you, the listeners. Thanks for tuning in every week. Your support encourages us to keep going and make bigger and better podcasts. So last week we had Sherry Ferguson on. That was a fun interview.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of fun to dive into a whole bunch of hyperbaric science. It's been a while since we've had a specialist on that topic. Yeah, lots of ground to cover, lots of neat things, and such a varied career that she's had.
I think, you know, one of the cool parts about listening to her story was this journey that led her to become, you know, the sort of the intellectual that she is in dive and barometric medicine, and seeing that it was more like a journey through diving that brought her to be the researcher that she is now. And so I found that pretty interesting, because it wasn't just one of these ones where you hear like, I happen to be a scientist who needed to learn to dive, but really her passion was driven by diving that led her to her career. So yeah, very cool story. And she certainly makes me think, I really am not smart enough to understand half of the stuff. So I got some work to do.
You know, it kind of goes with the theme of like the variety of guests we've had on this show, that there is a different pathway in diving for everyone. Mm-hmm. Virtually every single person's journey is unique, you know?
Yeah. And I think maybe that's the attractive thing about these kinds of discussions, right, is that we see that we can often end up in the same place through many different paths. And yeah, hers was a very interesting one.
Yep, that's the fun part about, I think, about this podcast, is talking to people. And, you know, it's cool to talk about specific things that they're doing, but I always find it interesting to find out how they got from point zero to point three, you know, like what were those steps and how did that zig and zag take them? And
I mean, it's like Michael, right? Like Michael hated Rex, and look what he's doing now.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It all goes all over the place, and you'll hear more about that later on the episode. Before we get to that, though, you had a follow-up on the Becoming Cousteau documentary that you talked about previously, Nick?
Yeah, I was, you know, like as you do, you check your email randomly, and then I had an invite for an online screening from National Geographic through, I think, the International Ocean Film Festival mailing list that I'm on or something. And it was literally like, you know, midway through Sunday morning, the email lands and it's like, oh, it's tonight. So I jumped at the chance, and had a chance to see the screening, which is, I think, still exclusively in cinemas. It's a pretty neat film. If you do get a chance when it becomes available near you to go watch it, it's literally the entire film is in its entirety on archival footage about Cousteau, and it kind of charts his whole life from start to finish, kind of like I had talked about previously. But I was actually just amazed by, you know, how they managed to put together an entire film with archival footage and wow, done in such a really neat way, and sort of highlighted parts of his life that, you know, most people probably don't know about, or some more obscure parts of his life as well. And then there was a sort of a half an hour Q&A with the director Liz Garbus and James Cameron at the end. So that was kind of cool to tune in as well. So yeah, I would,
very cool.
You know, in addition to it being one of my recommendations previously, I would definitely say if you have a chance to catch it somewhere, do that.
It is definitely one that I'm looking forward to seeing. And I think, I don't know, we've had a number of guests on the show, you know, and a recurring theme in most of their discussions happens to be, you know, I was inspired by Jacques Cousteau in some way, right? So even if you're not or you haven't heard of them and you're a younger diver that's kind of just coming into it now, and I would strongly suggest going back and taking up Nick on this recommendation. I haven't even seen the film, but I'm kind of chomping at the bit to be able to. And so I'm hoping that opportunity presents itself.
One last quick thing. One thing that really, really struck me was that even as far back as the 1960s, people were starting to understand the threats to the oceans that humans were causing. And the first clarion calls for action were sort of kind of emerging then. And it's a little scary to kind of watch that historical perspective, understanding where we are now and that we really haven't come that much further in progress. So, if you know, Jacques Cousteau was an impactful person. And I think that still probably plays a role in, you know, if you're somebody that hasn't heard of him or really has experienced his work because of a generational, you know, because you're of a different generation, I think that film will kind of bring you up to speed.
Well, I still haven't been to a movie since God knows when, 2 years or something now. So in a movie theater. So maybe if it comes to a movie theater here in Halifax, I'll go see it. It'll be my first outing.
Well, if you do, shoot me an invite. I'll see if I can make it.
You got it. It's a plan. All right. Also on the plan is tonight's guest. Tonight, we're speaking to Michael Schwinghammer. Michael's an avid Halifax diver who has a passion for exploring and preserving local wrecks and has been using photogrammetry to map them in three dimensions. Michael is also a scientific diver, a ship's team diver in the Royal Canadian Navy, and the president of the Shearwater Scuba Club. Welcome to the podcast, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're definitely happy to have you on today. How are you doing today?
Doing pretty well, honestly.
Well, that's good. No complaints is a good number of complaints, I guess.
Yeah. What else? What can you complain about? It's great weather right now.
Great weather. So says you, Michael. So says you. I mean, it's not snowing or raining or anything like that in Halifax here. So I guess it's good weather.
So would we call it the calm between storms? And this is the Nova Scotia thing to do, right? Like we have to talk about the weather randomly for no apparent reason, but
I think our guests are rolling their eyes because they listen to it every episode.
It's like, what is wrong with these people?
Mm-hmm. And Nick complains and
it's predictable. Predictable. Uh-oh. Does that mean, no, does not mean that we're predictable, does it? Good Lord.
Well, at some point we're going to talk about the weather. Just no way around it. Damn. All right. Well, we officially will start your interview and weather forecast in a moment, Michael. But for that, we have an article that was pretty interesting locally. And RCMP dive team closed a case after 22 years. Arlene McKellen left her home in Eastern Passage, Nova Scotia, almost 22 years ago and never returned. In the fall of 2020, RCMP divers were doing an unrelated search at a popular beach near Arlene's home, and they found not one but two cars underwater just off of a small bridge. The dive team investigated the first car, found it was unrelated to this case, but the second car, they were able to determine it was her car through the license plate and the matching of the car that was a Hyundai Accent. And then the divers had to spend some time actually removing the silt out of the car by hand because it had been there so long and it basically filled up with debris to determine that her remains were actually in the car still. The car has been underwater for so long, it's hard to determine the exact reason why it went off the road, though they suspect no foul play was involved. By making some key observations, which they were unable to describe, and they were able to determine that the vehicle likely accidentally left the roadway. This allowed investigators to give some much-needed relief and closure to McKellen family and former guest of the podcast, Mark Bishop, of the Nova Scotia RCMP dive team, was actually there, part of that recovery as well. So interesting development. That's really neat that they were able to provide that closure for that family after such a long time.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at those cases, they're obviously difficult on everybody. I can't imagine that it's a easy task to go about doing such a thing as recovering a vehicle like that. But effectively, the benefit to the family is usually quite huge. And I can imagine that if you've spent a good amount of years, you know, 22 in this case, wondering what happened to your your loved one, and you can finally have an answer to that question, as opposed to just, you know, nothing. It does bring a real sense of closure to it. It's a somber part of that kind of a work, I think, but in a way, also gives the, you know, those guys on the URT team, the underwater recovery team, some sense, I guess, of being able to contribute and help and give back a little bit. So really cool story from that regard. And yeah, I mean, if I guess we can look at episode 22, I think that's when Mark was on that show, and we can probably be able to get a little bit more information on how they go about the process of doing these sort of forensic investigations into accidents and or in certain other cases, criminal files.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely go back, take a listen to that. I can't believe that was episode 22. It was a long time ago. All right. Well, that's it for the news today. It's time to dive in with Michael Schwinghammer. So, Michael, tell us where you're from.
I'm from Montreal originally. Yeah, nowhere near the ocean. That's.
So, what's your first memory of the ocean then?
It'd actually be Cape Breton, I think. It would be around Cape Breton, I think. My parents used to drive us down here every year, and they would take us out to Briar Island and the other spots, and then we would just go and spend the summers there like a month every year. There and
yeah
it was nuts. You're turning over rocks for hours. So
how did you first hear about scuba diving, like the very first time?
Probably reading the Jacques Cousteau books. It definitely would have been there. I didn't see it anywhere growing up. Otherwise, I spent a lot of time in the water, like swimming on top, fishing and doing other stuff, but I never, until I was in university, I never dove. So yeah.
And then, so what was that thing that kind of transitioned from, you know, those memories of Jacques Cousteau to actually trying out scuba diving? What kind of made you pull that trigger?
It would have been the scientific diving class at Dow. And I was like, I'm going to do this. And I barely had any diving experience when I did it. And it was a mess for me. I don't know how I passed that course. I've actually got pictures of me just lying on the ground, almost in a fetal position, just like trying to do work. And it was a mess. I think they felt bad for me by the end.
And I guess, well, I mean, you started telling us a little bit about that, but I like the way that you started it. You know, like I stumbled on the scientific diving course, and then it almost kills me, and I'm lying on there at the end of it. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? I kind of want to hear that story.
So I took diving, and when you go through Dow, diving is like a massive thing for the marine biology program. It seems like every single one of those guys wants to go and dive. They love it. And I stumbled through there. I looked at what was going on at Dell, and I loved the marine biology program as I was going through. It was a cool spot. And I was like, I could do this. The diving is one of those things. You go out and you make these great friendships. It's sort of like a kinship that you develop with people, especially if you're diving with one set of people and you're doing it constantly there. And it was fantastic. I ran Dal Scuba for two years, I think, there. But it was rough when you're first going through. Yeah. Learning to dive sucks.
So was there anything, I just, you know, when I'm thinking about that, was there anything specific about training with the Dal Scuba Club that would have been maybe different from the way that, say, the average open water student runs through a paddy course?
So Dallas, those type of clubs, just because I run Shearwater and everything else, it's all the, generally speaking, you go through a paddy course like anywhere else. It's a little bit more personalized when you're going through it. I actually went through my course with Torpedo Rays, but when we do them through Shearwater, we did them through Dow Scuba, and we got people going out there. It's just like a smaller program. And it's kind of more tailored to the individuals that can go through it at that time, because you don't have a massive group size that you're doing. You're teaching at any point. But okay. Other than that, it's the same course that you're going through. The same skills that you have to accomplish for everything.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. And so now you didn't just stick to that one, you know, Dal Scuba course. You pursued other certifications. So can you tell us a bit about how your diving career has progressed?
Initially, So I've spent a fair bit of time in the water, but I think I spent my first 100 dives just on the open water. And then I went through and I was, because I didn't really believe in getting my advanced or anything else. And then I started looking at doing boat charters and people were hesitant to take me out. I was like, I've got 100 dives. What do you want me to do? And
do an advanced.
Well, I mean, it's one of those situations. Yeah. Like, and they were like, you need your advanced. So went, got my advanced. And then I think there's this like stigma that had, if you don't do keep going further with it at some point. So I got my rescue diver probably a year or two, 3 years after that. And then I just kept diving. And I didn't go further with it for a long time. I started looking at more of the tech side of things in recent years. And that's mostly because I kind of want to start staying down for longer. If I'm going to be going and doing working with wrecks and doing this, like the marine archaeology or the scientific diving, and you don't consume much air when you're going down there, especially if you're calm and you're just in that happy space, your no decompression limits don't mean anything to you. I stay down at 20 meters. I'm only using up like a quarter of my tank sometimes. By the time my no decompression limit's done, and I'm like, I don't really feel like going up, but the computer's screaming at me. So that's why I started in tech diving.
So is that where you see yourself?
I've started into tech diving. I just did my intro to tech course. I completed that finally. It took me about a year because struggles are real. But I did my intro to tech, and now I'm going to start working towards my tech one with NAWI. And it's fascinating. It's interesting when you actually have a purpose for diving. It changes the game from like going on a walk in the park to doing other stuff.
Yeah, and then once you start fiddling with the tech side, you get a new appreciation of diving as well, because you have more knowledge and more skills, and you look at diving differently. So that's pretty cool. So we're kind of excited to see you go down the journey, and hopefully it goes well. I do have a question for you though. I know you've explored some off the beaten paths dive sites, if we may call it that, Lee, because I know you've been around Digby and you've been in the Shubi as well. Why go to those places and what's the diving like there?
The diving is different. This is one of those things where you want to be as diverse as possible when you're a diver around here. And when a lot of the people that go out on the weekends, they go to like a couple of set spots, and it doesn't change much, but we're kind of blessed with this fantastic variety of environments around here. We have these massive aggregations of striped bass that are coming through in the Shubenacadie. And then you have crazy currents going through the Bay of Fundy. And then this cold water ocean that's coming down. And it all changes. It's really, really neat for me. So I do whatever type of diving I can. I've been in the Bay of Fundy once or twice there, or maybe three, four times, because I go up by Parsboro. I've been down by Briar Island before. Then the Shubenacadie, I love it because you can find artifacts in there. If you are willing to explore these places and go where people have not been before, you can find all types of crazy stuff right now. I'm not saying pillage. Don't pillage. Pillaging is bad. But like to actually go and see things that haven't been found before. There's canal boats out there, and they just haven't been documented at all.
When did this treasure hunting or maybe bottle hunting, because I know you like to do, when did that hit your radar? Is that when you started diving these other locations, or was it before that?
It was something to do in the winter. The winter diving around here is pretty bleak when it comes to wildlife, and I was looking for stuff to do. Because let's face it, when you're looking at nudibranchs, you're going out, you're doing like, you're focusing very much on the small stuff at that point in the winter. And I could only keep my attention going for so long. So I started looking at the bottle diving, and I got really interested by it. It's like a seasonality thing for me. And in the winter, when you have this great viz and you can't get onto the wrecks at that point, we have these old historic harbors here where we can find this really, really cool stuff from a couple of hundred years ago. And like, this is big. People in the southern states would love this. And like, you go over to England, people are jumping around to get at it. But I love it here.
Yeah, I've seen some cool stuff pulled out of a muddy harbor bottom, and some places are harder to dive than others, like active cruise ship docking areas and things like that. But you're right, those areas have been used for hundreds of years, and there's so much down there.
Absolutely.
Earlier, you were talking about you went being involved with like the Dal Scuba Club. And now you're president of the Shearwater Scuba Club. For those that might not know, can you give a bit of background about the club and like who it serves, who its members are?
So we are a military dive club. It's a recreational club. Mm-hmm. And I cannot give you the proper background. It's one of those things, it's been around forever. they used to do a lot of really, really cool stuff. Because the military used to like allow these recreation days, and back in the day when the budgets were very, very loose and you could get away with whatever you wanted, they would like take helicopters out and fly generators onto various islands and do these crazy explorations and expeditions.
Oh wow!
And yeah, it hasn't happened with me. I don't have that budget. But no, what we do is we organize dives and we get a bunch of cool people together to go and actually try and do, like, we're always in the water throughout the whole year. You're going to have a constant group there. And it's kind of cool to meet military people in this setting. It's very, very relaxed. And we also have a pool that for some reason, like, it's underappreciated a lot of times, but yeah, we get a pool every Monday night. So I love it.
It's pretty cool.
Non-COVID times, even non-military people can come to that, right? But not right now.
Yeah, COVID really messed up a lot of our stuff there. We just got access back ourselves, and at the moment, it's strictly limited to military, DND, and families, unfortunately.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense. They've got to mitigate that risk in the meantime.
It does make sense.
I guess, so now, in that role as a president, is there anything you're hoping to achieve in your time there?
No, continuation of the club.
straightforward.
Clubs like this survive because people have the willpower to push them forward. And it can be grueling when you're like one of two people that shows up for something and you're like, damn it, why am I doing this? And you're doing it for those times where someone needs it. And like, you get a lot of military people to come out, and like, this is their happy spot sometimes, but they don't always come out. And yeah, if I can make it a little bit easier for anyone else like that, I will show up every single night that I have to, and or every single night that I can, honestly.
Yeah. That's very cool. I'm curious, Michael, there's been like a large interest in the dive community, and I've seen this elsewhere, where folks in the military may be dealing with things like occupational stress injuries or PTSD related issues. And then they find that diving is actually a great outlet to ensure that they can kind of find some relief from that and or bring themselves to a place where in the moment of diving, things work well for them and they don't have to deal with some of those stresses. Have you guys ever given any thought to doing that sort of work with the club? And I ask primarily because it's something that I've actually thought of doing myself through Torpedo Razor, even on my own. But I've just never had the connection to those groups of people or the access to the equipment and space to be able to do it.
I've thought about it. I don't think it's as easy to set up as we'd sort of think about it. I'd love to do it because those are the people that, like, I really want to make sure are good. I just haven't had the opportunity yet, honestly. And it'd be a fair bit of work, I believe, to set it all up. I would do it in a second if I knew what I was doing in any way. But yeah.
Fair enough. Now, you're also a diver as part of your day job in the military, a ship team diver to be specific. What might a typical task in that role entail?
A typical task in that role would be you'd be doing poker gauges or various, it's, you're doing ship husbandry stuff. You're not doing any big jobs. You're going to be going and you'll do poker gauges to go and check the wear on the shafts, and you'll be cleaning sensors underwater. You might be going and taking off lines if there's stuff on the props, and it's a limited amount of diving that you'll be doing for the scope. It's fun. I like it. It's a chance to get in the water, but.
What kind of training did you have to do to become a ship steam diver?
6 weeks of fun at the fleet diving unit.
Yeah. What's that like?
I enjoyed it quite a bit. Yeah. I mean, it's the one picture I actually have on my wall for like anything military. I really, really enjoyed the course. It is a grueling course. It is the most fun I've had so far. And I always recommend people take it.
I think for our military listeners, I think those guys would have a firm idea. But when, you know, I'm still trying to visualize this in my head and figure out, like, so when you say it was a grueling and fun course, are we talking like Navy SEAL buds training here? That's what I have in my head. Or is it similar to that? Is it different from that?
No, I would say there's lots of confirmation of combat knowledge, though. And you go through... It's a course where they put stress on you, and the way they put stress on you is through a physical aspect. So you're going to, the diving is easy in this course, but you're going to be spending a lot of time in the water, a lot of time doing squats, push-ups, running around. It's a good time. It's hilarious in the end. And a lot of the stuff in the military, if you keep this frame of reference that like this is not real life in a lot of ways, and you're like, this is hilarious at the same time, you can have a great time.
So how does somebody, if you don't mind me asking, how does somebody that sort of did marine biology and then did a scientific diving course end up in the armed forces?
You do a lot of floundering, but I've had three lives. I sort of look at it right now. I did the marine biology program and the oceanography program, and I realized that was not for me. By my third year into this like 4.5 year saga, I was like, I have made a mistake, and I didn't trust myself to just bounce out at that point and go into engineering. And I continued on with it. I went and I got to do some really, really cool stuff in this marine biology program. But I went and I worked and I went to the Marine Institute after that in Newfoundland to do the ROV tech program. And from there, I got to work with some subsea survey companies, and I did some aquaculture stuff. And I was working on all these weird remotely operated vehicles, but the work wasn't consistent. And I honestly needed the stability. You can talk about a lot of stuff with the Navy and the CAF, but if you need that structure, it's there. And like for an older person, sometimes it's a saving grace when you come through it and you're like, this is actually what I have to do. And it's, you know it at any point. But it was good. I like it. Wouldn't change anything about it.
It's interesting that you still connect with the ocean through those through multiple phases of your life. And it's still a strong part of your life, it seems.
Yeah, it's been a constant.
That's awesome. All right. Well, we'll take a brief surface interval right here. We'll be back with more from Michael Schwinghan. Thanks for tuning into this week's podcast. Remember, you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or at podchaser.com. Reviews are one of the best ways to help others find the podcast.
This episode of Dive In the Podcast is brought to you by Torpedo Rays Scuba.
You can find them online at torpedorays.com.
They've been teaching Canada how to dive for 25 years and are a proud sponsor of this podcast.
If you're in Atlantic Canada and want to take a course or see the shop, stop in and see us in Dartmouth and check out the huge selection of scuba, apnea, surf gear, and much more.
Dive tours are available for locals and visitors to experience all that our ocean playground has to offer.
TorpedoRays.com has a vast selection of dive gear at unbeatable prices, with free shipping available in Canada and quick shipping throughout North America.
So visit TorpedoRays.com or stop in the shop, and you might even see one of us there.
Welcome back to Dive in the Podcast. We're speaking with Michael Schwinghammer, an avid Halifax diver who has been using photogrammetry to document local wrecks. So, Michael, what is it that initially piqued your interest in wrecks?
Honestly, at first, I hated them.
That's a good place to start.
I found wreck diving to be the worst thing ever. And I don't know. I think it was the photogrammetry. I realized I could do something fun. And it gave me a purpose to wreck diving. And it was weird. But I realized I could do something that most people couldn't do.
What is it about wrecks that you hated or didn't like initially?
I don't think I understood them fully, honestly. It working like on a seagoing vessel, you kind of get a different appreciation for it now. But when I was going through initially, I was like, this is a structure, and like I could be, you know, going on the cliffside or something like that. I'd have more fun, like more chances of seeing wildlife. But nowadays, I'm like, okay, this is actually something that it's not a very dynamic environment, but they change quite a bit over time. And that's one of these like neat things you can actually track. But and you never know what you're going to see on a wreck, too, and like around these wrecks.
Guess we'll get into that a bit more later.
Yeah. But yeah, it's different. When you go down on these wrecks, it's a lot of history that you can find now, and you get to see what was once like this sailing vessel and was someone's life. And when you are a sailor and you do this and you're like, you're in this thing, you just, it's like looking at the burnt out remains of a house pretty much. It's so weird to see. And mm-hmm. I find it fascinating.
And so would you say then that's why you've decided to invest your time documenting and mapping those wrecks? It's that historical perspective or anything else that maybe attracts you to that process?
It's two or three things. We did a lot of damage to these wrecks. When you start looking at the history of it all, especially like in this type of area where the salvage was done with these massive claws that we dropped down and just like they'd rip everything out of the wrecks. And then in our area here too, we had a treasure trove act where people were just salvaging what they could for a long, long time. It wasn't as monitored as it should have been. And nowadays it's closed down entirely, but people are still actively going on these wrecks and taking stuff. And when you can do the type of mapping that I do now, you can actually sort of see the disturbances that happen in these sites when suddenly deck plates are missing in one area and have been moved to another. Hmm. Or, you know, these suddenly you have piles that are just springing up left and right. It's kind of interesting to track that. And yeah, that's a big thing for me. I kind of want to be able to see what's going on. I want others to see what's there.
So to document these wrecks, you're using a technique known as photogrammetry. Can you describe for our listeners like what it is and how it works? Like what do you do underwater to make it work? And then what happens when you get home?
It is so difficult to say how photogrammetry works. Because essentially you're creating 3D images out of still pictures or still images. And that's accomplished through this thing called structure from motion. And it's looking at similar points and using the pixels and like to go and actually figure out, okay, this is one spot is here and it's in another image, it's right here. And they can see the differences in like they can apply depth to it at that point. For me, I've been trying to figure out an elegant way of saying this, and you can find the depth to a structure from this if you look at it from different points. So if you were to look at side scan, you could see the scat the shadow of an image to figure out how tall it is. And that's how photogrammetry works. Is you have a bunch of images and you figure out the common points between them, and it kind of links it all together. And I'm sure there's going to be someone that's going to hate me for the way I've said it here. But yeah, it's an incredibly complex thing.
You just kind of, do you take photos from different angles, or do you swim above the wreck, or like, how does it work?
I try and figure out a path that I'm willing to take and a survey grid while I'm down there. And I kind of do it on the fly. And so I go around the contours of the wreck generally at first, and I'm either taking still images or I'm taking video. And from there, I can get the scale of the wreck, and I sort of do crisscrossing into the wreck and make a survey route from inside around it. And it's not generally enough to just have the sides or the on top. You kind of want the whole structure if you can. So you're going around the wreck, you're going on top of the wreck, you're doing everything you can to get all of the contours of the wreck from there. It takes forever. You don't really realize what you're doing, and you can get lost. it's super easy to just start going down one path and then realize, oh, damn it, I have no clue where I am. All of a sudden, you're like, just turning around, going through. But it's cool. You go down there and you're taking these images. Then it's hundreds, if not thousands, of images that you're taking. I built a rig with 3 GoPros that I'm using right now, and you're just going down. You're taking as many images as possible, and you can filter those out later on, and you run it through a program, and this is going to do the bulk of the work for you when you're doing photogrammetry. And it will take forever. It's easier to just get a processing computer or find someone with a processing computer to run everything for you, because I remember when I first started this, I was locking up my laptop for a week at a time as it was doing these simple models for me.
And wow.
Yeah, the calculations are not easy that they're doing, but it's cool. Like, And the end result is a 3D model that you can have and you can sort of scroll through. There's some guys out there that are doing beautiful, beautiful models right now. And from there, you can get the programs to create these large scale photos called orthomosaics orthophotos. And it's this 2D image that is the entire model, or like compressed model. And you can see tons and tons of details. I can see rivets on most of my wrecks right now. That's cool.
How did you learn how to do this?
Through stubbornness. There's a lot of headbanging. I went through and I saw someone had done the Thistlegorm wreck in the Red Sea. And I was like, it was one of those moments where I think I was making fun of photogrammetry. There's that Mark Wahlberg movie where Buddy's making fun of something, and then he's like, I have to learn how to do this, and he becomes better at it just to make fun of the person more. And it sounds awful, but like, I didn't respect it at all. And then I got sucked into it, and I started doing more and more, and yeah, suddenly like, I realized there weren't many people doing this at all, and like, I became one of the people, like, there was no one doing it on the East Coast when I originally started. Now there's like maybe one or two people more, but it's this weird, weird path where you go down and all of a sudden you learn to respect something more, and it you get these cool results too. Mm-hmm. It's the mix between science and art, which is what I find really, really cool about it.
That is pretty awesome.
Is that why you chose photogrammetry, or is there other ways of documenting these sites?
You can make a 3D model from multi-beam, but when you're, and that's all on top, that's on your top side. So that'll be from a vessel. You'll be going doing that. But when it comes to being to like a diver collecting this data, it you can't do anything else, I'm pretty sure. Or you could use, there's stuff called like synthetic aperture sonar, SAS. That'll let you do some really, really beautiful stuff. But when it comes to, you know, what we can do, I don't believe so. This is the only way of doing it right now.
So like the podcast I used to listen to, one of the hosts was built a rig to use a LIDAR scanner to scan the interiors of caves as he was, you know, caving. Is that something that can be tied into it? Like, can you do some scans to get higher detailed data or something?
You could absolutely do that. The LIDAR equivalent of that would be multi-beam that most people would be doing. Mm-hmm. There, you can mount a multi-beam sonar on an ROV or something else, but it's really not easy to do for like the average diver or even like someone with technical expertise. Mm-hmm. I saw this really, really cool model recently, and like it's survey companies doing this stuff now too. Like these guys are getting into it, and they're putting down poles and like with cameras, and they're using RTK, and so like this super accurate. So their GPSs are super, super accurate. And it's not just like the enthusiasts and the drone people like it used to be. Yeah. It's everybody.
So photogrammetry, would you say that's like an accessible kind of technology for the average person that's looking to get into something like that?
I believe it is accessible. It is extremely frustrating. well, there are... It's something that people, when you learn it, you don't want to show everyone else how it's done. it's silly, but you need quite a bit of gear to do it because you're looking at your cameras and then you're looking at the programs and then you're looking at the computers to go and actually run all the programs. But what you don't have to do anything that well. Initially, to create a basic model, you can do it with a GoPro, and you can do it on a laptop and with one of these programs. It's going to take a while to do. Figuring out how to do it is the frustrating part, and like how to actually do a proper survey for photogrammetry and for the mapping it's not easy.
And so, I mean. As you're describing it there, I kind of picture like the work of the underwater photographer, videographer, and just all the complications that come with it. And you're mentioning that it isn't easy. What's causing, like, what is it specifically that causes this sort of frustration that you're talking about, but then still like entices you to go out and do it despite that frustration?
What causes me frustration is biomass and kelp. It is the amount of time that we spend going in and clearing wrecks right now is nuts. A buddy of mine is an underwater archaeologist, and we probably spend once a week about an hour underwater, just you know, cutting, and we're down there. Just that's all you do. You're literally just going all around the wreck. But when you create these models and especially like in our waters where we don't get the 20-30 meter viz that other people get in other parts of the world, we get like 10 if we're lucky most of the time. And when you can see these wrecks that are massive and you can experience them properly, for me it's something that I just like. I'm always astounded by the beauty of it. Because I, personally, I'm also narked half the time. And this gives me a reference point for what I've actually been seeing on my dives. I'm like, oh, I know where I am finally.
There's definitely time for that tech course.
It's true.
So I'm thinking about this technology, and when you combine it with like VR headsets or like 3D printer, you can give divers and non-divers alike an amazing access to information about these wrecks without them ever having to get in the water. Is there a lot of people doing it? Are they sharing these models? And
there are a couple of people doing it. There's a couple of groups doing it, and those guys are all they're doing really, really, really cool work. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been able to successfully push a lot of my stuff out like that. You kind of look at, there isn't a massive amount of interest I've found for this type of stuff. I love it. And mm-hmm. it's one of those things where, like, you do these quirky things that you just have to enjoy for yourself. And yeah.
It seems like an interesting way to be able to survey, know what you have, document natural resources and, or document these resources and bring that to the surface so that people can kind of understand that and conceptualize it better.
I mean, I think it would be pretty cool if you had a VR headset of your 3D models in the Maritime Museum for people to look at.
Yeah.
I think
I sent them stuff and they did not go and respond to me.
Well, keep knocking on that door, because I think that would be kind of an awesome thing for even for kids, mm-hmm. somebody that hasn't been on the water. That'd be so awesome.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
I mean, I don't know. I think it's kind of cool. I've still got your sailboat 3D printed here.
Yes.
from the harbor. Let's see, explain this to people who aren't from here. There's a small finger kind of harbor that local divers use or local boaters use, and somebody left their sailboat tied up all winter one winter and it sunk. And this was one of your earlier photogrammetry projects, right?
It's like a super tiny boat, and I was actually out searching for another one that was around there, or supposedly around there, and yeah, we came across this one. I was like, ooh, great little project. And yeah it's fun.
Yeah, I should give this to you at some point, because I've probably had it here for a year or two now.
One of those COVID projects, right? It's so, I meant to do that.
Got any more 3D models for me to print, Mike?
Nothing that fun. A lot of the stuff I've been working on is flattened right now. Yeah. This year was a weird year with me being deployed, but
yeah, that's fair.
Spent 9 months away from home and kind of.
That's definitely a rough life.
Didn't take your giant photogrammetry rig with you on deployment, and shoot the bottom of some ships or something.
we actually got to dive a wreck in Norway, and that was super cool. Perks to being in being a diver or a ship team diver in the military. You do get to go around and have some pretty fun experiences.
That's cool.
Michael, I got to ask you. So the long run project here, you're mapping all these wrecks. What do you say, I guess, as you're going through this process and mapping these wrecks, what is it that you want to accomplish by doing these mapping?
I think there's two things I want to accomplish. I want to create a database of what is actually out there currently. A lot of times, the state of the wrecks that we have are kind of questionable, and they're fairly deep. We don't actually get the full pictures of what's out there. And secondly, I kind of want, my partner says that this is my master's project if I ever want to do it, but I don't really want to work on this. I want to track the state of what's happening with storms and kind of the pilfering on these wrecks and see the degradation over time. Because realistically, I can go back. So we talk about 3D models, but you can actually do a 4D model, and you can integrate time into it. So you can take this model that you have and then see what's changed over time through the years at set points in time. And we get some very serious storm action here, as you guys know. And I think it'd be super neat to see every few hurricanes how these wrecks have changed, because the deck plating will change, the positioning of a lot of the stuff. And there's some of these wrecks are right on the size of cliffs, and they just go down eventually. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so you mentioned two pieces there. Like, obviously, the time lapse component is one that, you know, as Mother Nature kind of exerts her force on these wrecks, those things are out of our control in terms of how wrecks change. But you've mentioned it a couple of times now, the pilfering on wrecks and how that causes change. What would you say to folks who are, you know, removing items or artifacts from wrecks?
There are people doing stuff that I don't agree with at all. It's one thing to take a bottle. The pilfering that really, really bothers me is when, like, a lot of our wrecks here are unfortunately graves for people. This is what happens when you live next to the ocean. Like, this is the reason we have lighthouses all over the place, is because there was a lot of loss of life that occurred here. And there are people out there right now that are going out and doing some horrendous stuff. And they're breaking up this black matter that comes from the bottom of the ocean. And it's sort of like solidified body parts at this point. And they're taking rings and necklaces out of there. And it...
Wow, I didn't know that.
They're desecrating graves. Yeah, there's a couple of guys that I know that are, or I've heard of doing this. And I, you know, as someone who's like working on the sea, it's an awful feeling to know that, like, I could be reduced to that at some point. When you go and you pilfer these things, you ruin the context, and like it ruin the context for archaeologists and like the history of it all. But like it's just destroying graves, and I can't do that, honestly. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
hadn't quite thought about it in that context, because the defense I usually hear from people is that the items underwater are being, you know, wrecks and stuff, more than small items, but being destroyed. So if something is found and taken, then like, oh, we're actually saving it from being, you know, slowly wasting away to nothing. But I guess then at the same time, that that gold fever kind of thing goes in, and so you're taking a porthole, you're taking a ring, you're taking hadn't thought about it in that context.
So one of the scary things, like, people take shoes occasionally. They don't check what's inside the shoes until like they're up sometimes. And, you know, sometimes there's stuff in there. It's not a happy place.
Yeah. Have you done any other science or unusual kind of diving?
I help Chris Harvey Clark with some torpedo ray tagging. That is always a hoot. Chris Harvey Clark is a veterinarian at Dal. He does a lot of marine research, and I'll help him occasionally with his torpedo ray tagging, and that is so much fun. We go out and we'll go to some of these, you know, secret spots that he's got. In a size of a volleyball court, he'll find 13 or 14 or up to 18 torpedo rays at once, I believe. And these are these large creatures that have the capability of creating a high voltage current between their I'm missing the word entirely. I'm gesturing on a podcast. That doesn't work. I'd say wings, but that's not the term for it. But
yeah. What someone might imagine as the wings of a ray.
And to go out there and see all these large creatures out there, and they're not always happy to be poked and prodded and tagged. So they'll come around, like, swim at you, and you push them away.
That's interesting. Yeah. Because we don't know a whole lot about what they do when they're not in this area, right? Is that the deal?
We don't know a whole lot about them in general. We don't know a lot about a lot of the fisheries out there that aren't really commercially important.
Yeah.
Or cute. Needs to be cute.
Torpedo rays are kind of cute.
So maybe another cute thing we can talk about, back in the podcast Time Machine, in episode 87, you kind of came on and shared your initial experience with a great white encounter that you had while diving with Chris Harvey Clark for Torpedo Rays near Duncan's Cove about a month ago. How are you feeling now that you've had some time to process that encounter?
It was the most, I said it before, it's the most wonderful and terrifying moment of my life. It was an adrenaline rush for like a couple of days, and then it was down, and like waking up at 3 a.m. and there was a lot of nerves, and there's still a lot of nerves that goes around it. I don't think most people would understand the experience. I've talked with some people about it, and there's been this feeling like, oh, you know, we go out with in these areas where there's bears and all this other stuff, but really the great whites are like the top of the food chain when you consider it. And it's more like when I talk about it now and people ask me about it, I'm like, it's how you would feel if you accidentally wandered into a tiger pen at a zoo, and then the tiger was just wandering around here for a little bit. And I don't think that I've fully processed it entirely yet. I was talking to Chris the other day, and he was not even sure it was just one shark we were looking at, because the one I saw might have been a different one that he saw. And they kind of do that in these areas. You can control two things when you're diving. You have like the confidence in your kit, the confidence in yourself, and then you have to deal with the environment, and you choose which environment you're in generally. And that was one of those days where we had no control over the environment all of a sudden. And I think it was a scary moment, honestly, because you go through it, and I'm still like, I've got nerves about it right now. I go into the water, I'm like, oh, what's beyond the veil at this point?
You got eyes in the back of your head.
Yeah.
Because I was going to ask you, you had some pretty strong feelings about, you know, diving with sharks right after that experience, and you know, totally understandable. But I was going to ask you if kind of your view had changed on that a little bit.
I don't think I'd ever do that part again. Being an accidental great white shark diver is doing that once is all I'll ever want to do, honestly. There's something very different about having a planned dive to see a shark than violating all the rules that, you know, Chris and I had normally set up for these type of things. Like, you don't dive near a seal colony when there's sharks around. Well, we were doing that. When you're in low vis water, you don't dive around an ambush predator that comes up from the bottom or the sides. We were doing that. You don't have to go and like be on the surface or on a boat. We were doing that. It could have. We were very fortunate that it worked out the way it did, and I think all we could do is control our reactions to that thing. And he was telling me that the shark came within like 15 feet of him when it did one of the passes. And that's really close for a 10-foot shark that's 1,000 pounds.
I mean, you said you still got head on a swivel when you're diving at this point, but the water's cooled off now quite a bit, and chances of seeing a great white are pretty low at this point, but so have you been back to that area since?
No, honestly, that it might take me a while to get back and do that type of stuff. At first I was like, I just need to go and get back in the water and do all this stuff. But you go through and you dive, like you do all this diving where you're like confident in everything. And I've been in some hairier situations underwater, but this was just, it knocked a lot of the confidence out of me. And it might take me a year to get fully back into it. As far as I'm seeing right now, it's a realistic timescale. And I don't think I'll ever, or I don't think I'll be diving those spots as much once the water warms up. Mm. And I've got nothing against sharks. I actually think they're super, super cool. And it's just when you're dealing with it in the wrong circumstances and you're creating the potential for hazard. You know, there's the saying, there's old divers, there's bull divers, but there's no old bull divers. And I'm not a Yahoo. I try to plan as much as I can. And I don't think I'll be going back there from August onwards. Once the waters are warm, I'll move on to other portions of it that I know a little bit better. And there's a lot for me to do still. It's one of those things until I'm ready to deal with that in that situation. You can cause a hazard for yourself if you're not good on all three.
It's a very unique experience to come to grips with. So that's, we really appreciate you sharing that with us, opening up about that, honestly. So before we kind of wrap things up today, I was just wondering if you had any projects on the go or any more mappings or anything like that you have planned for the near future.
Oh, I'm really excited. There's a copper-clad wreck in the Narrows of Halifax Harbor. And it went down around the time of the Halifax explosion. I'd been meaning to go and map this one for a few years, but I think it's finally within reach. And okay. It's a chance for me to do something that's extremely local. I'm not a fan of like having to go drive a massive distance to go and then boat a massive distance and see something. But when I've got all these crazy, beautiful wrecks that are right around me and not very well documented, I try and fly it out if I can.
Do you have a favorite so far?
I would say the Letitia, but that's kind of got a...
Is it tainted now?
The Letitia was a beautiful wreck. It is a beautiful wreck. The Isle Wharf is super cool. It's hard to say. A lot of those Shabucto head wrecks are fantastic. It's just you never know what you're going to see when you're on them. And there's nerves right now that are not entirely justified for like a reality check, but yeah.
for reference, for people I probably listening don't know, those would be wrecks that would be within a couple kilometers or maybe even just a kilometer of Duncan's Cove there where you saw the white, I guess, right?
They would be probably within 10 meters to...
you were right. At
Yeah, we can see all, they were within probably 100 to 1 kilometer of where we were. And there's a lot of really, really cool wrecks out there. This whole area is like littered with wrecks, as you guys know. And they've all got perks and quirks. The one I was working on, the Isle Wharf, that's probably one of my favorite wrecks too. And one of the things that you sort of, when you go down there, I've been down there with Nick, and you turn and you're like, oh, I'm going to keep going one way with a wreck. And then you're like, oh, this is massive. What's going on? And you come back and you're like, oh, there's a bit more of the wreckage, and you go down and it's even larger. And like, oh, damn it. I have to spend so much more time modeling this now. And it's like, you can't focus at all because you're just, your head's split. But yeah.
I love the excitement. I absolutely do. I did want to know, if somebody was interested in seeing some of the models you've made, is there a place that people can follow you on social media, maybe?
There is an Instagram that I use. It'd be michael.swinghammer. Woo! But, most of the stuff I push out through there, or I'll do through my Facebook page, but eventually there'll be a website. It's one of those things where I don't do a lot of social media. social media is kind of this thing that there's some people that appreciate it and then there's others that don't, and it's balancing for everything. So I don't do a massive amount unless I'm talking about my wrecks or diving a bit. And yeah, I stay off of it for the most part. Well,
when you get the website up, you let us know, and we can share that with the audience.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks.
No problem.
Yeah, that'd be easy share for sure.
So, Michael, what keeps you diving?
It's like my happy spot. I was talking to someone today and I was like, it's my space where I go where I'm like in a meditative state. You talk about, like, for those of us that lead kind of chaotic lives, it's this like point where I control everything that I'm doing. I decide whether or not I'm going to be going up, down, or I'm moving to any bit. And there's something about like the breathing regimens that you go through when you're diving. Everything slows down and you enter this state of just pure bliss if you're doing it properly, or at least I do. Maybe that's another sign that I'm narked out of my mind, but I think that's what keeps me going, is that there's this calming effect that I'll always be going for. And there's this a search for like documenting what isn't fully well known or respected in a lot of ways. I'll go with that.
That's awesome. That's a great answer, Michael. And I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and chatting about photogrammetry and your history, and get to learn some stuff about you, even though I've known you for like, I don't know, I met you probably 10 years ago now or something. Thanks for coming on, man.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that was an awesome interview, and we thank Michael again for coming on to the show.
It's time to gear up with a book recommendation. Nick, you've got one for us this week?
This week, I've got a book called Changing Tides by Alejandro Freed. Changing Tides, it's subtitled An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. This book's written by a marine ecologist who has worked on a number of projects, often in collaboration with First Nations, and it's set on the west coast of Canada. And for a little context, the Anthropocene is sort of a proposed geological period, which follows the current period known as the Holocene, which has kind of been marked by, you know, the last 11,000 years of a stable climate that has allowed humans to settle and thrive. And kind of what's unique about this new proposed geological period is it kind of revolves around people's impacts on the planet, and that we've basically changed the planet so much that we've kind of created a brand new geological period. And sort of kind of given how normalized, like, you know, the regular spate of weekly news of depressing environmental issues is these days, that this book is quite timely. And Frid relates his perspectives based mostly on his work, like on the changes that we have witnessed in our environment, and offers insight into hopeful and practical solutions based in large part at looking at indigenous approaches that he has witnessed throughout his work. And I think where divers will find this book interesting is that it's an exploration of the relationship of people in the ocean, both historical and potential future. And the book is accessible, so it's really well written. It's free of any complicated scientific jargon. If anybody is interested in, you know, the ecology, the marine ecology of the West Coast, there'll be something in there for you. And it's filled with sort of really nice prose. It's filled with adventures both on and under the waves. It's also available from a publisher called New Society Publishers, which is a social shareholder enterprise model that has roots in Canada and the US. So the book will ship close to home if you're in North America. So if you're kind of looking for something a little different, but still with a very strong ocean context, and that is fitting for our times, I think this will kind of make a great gift for someone close to you.
Awesome. Sounds like a good read. I'll have to check it out. We've had some really good science communicators on our podcast, and always nice when you can take a difficult subject matter and break it down for us numbskulls like me.
I find it a really interesting book because he talks about, you know, the different fisheries that people are working on and traditional methods of harvesting, but then he also talks, you know, about the glass sponges, and I know we've had Hamish Tweed on here talk about his experiences with glass sponges, so a diver will be able to relate and connect to a lot of those things.
That's awesome. Look forward to checking it out sometime. Speaking of time, I guess that's it. We're at the end of the episode, so it's my job to thank everybody. First, I want to thank Michael Schwinghammer for joining us. It was a great time on the interview. Really got to know him a bit better, and it was fun chatting with him. Used to see him around the dive shop all the time, but now I haven't seen him in a while, so good catching up there. I also want to thank you, Nick, for everything you do on the show. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
All right, and Mitt, thank you.
Very happy to be here.
All right, and thanks go out to April, of course. She helps us out always. She's off being a movie star today, so look for her on stage and screen in the near future at a I don't know.
TV show near you?
I think it's a movie. Yeah, pretty sure it's a movie. We'll let her explain that at another time. Anyway, after production's complete.
That's right. And, no spoilers. Don't want to lose your gig here.
That's it. Exactly. So don't forget, you can support this podcast on patreon.com/diveinpod and get some fun rewards for doing so. You can visit our website, diveinpod.com, for all the links you need, episodes, merch, and so much more. On social media, you can follow me at iDiveOK. April is at April Weichert.
You can find me at nicholaswinkler.com.
Next week, we speak to Brett Seymour, the Deputy Chief and Audiovisual Production Specialist with the U.S. National Park Service Submerged Resource Center.
This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Race Scuba.
Thank you for listening.